All right, everyone, good afternoon. It is February 24th, 2016, and this is the House Committee on Rules. So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to start at the bottom of the agenda, open a public hearing on House Bill 1541A for the purposes of taking testimony from Senator Haass and Representative Doherty. I'll close that out. We'll move up to 4004 and then back to 1541, and then we'll move up from the bottom. So that's the plan. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1541A. Invite up Senator Haass.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1541A directs the Oregon Department of Education to conduct evaluation related to expenditure variations among school districts, specifies contents of evaluation, requires the department to report to interim legislative committees on education no later than December 15th, 2015. There is an emergency clause on this measure. It comes to you with no revenue and minimal fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Haass.
Thank you, Chair Williamson. Committee, Mark Haass from Washington County. I feel kind of bad. There's about 17 House members here waiting to speak to you on another bill, so I'll try to be brief. And for the record, I, too, support the statute bill.
Thank you.
This bill, let me just explain by giving you some perspective. We have a system of distributing K through 12 money based on equalization in this state. That's how we do it. The premise is that we spend an equal amount per pupil on every student from Lake Oswego to Lake County. So, if every district receives about the same amount per student, why is it that the David Douglas School District has 180 school days and the Morrow County School District has 150 days? Park Rose, 167 days, Oregon City, 177 days. Why do we have those fluctuations? Or why is it that some school districts spend their K through 12 money on college for kids who have finished their requirements for high school? It's not a bad thing, but it's certainly outside of the K through 12 budget parameters that we mistakenly believe exist. And here's another one. Last year, the legislature approved about a 10% raise in the K through 12 budget, but some school districts over 2 years raised salaries more than 10%, or they hired new administrators, or they did both, and as a result, class sizes went up. Administrators told parents to blame the legislature for not funding schools, which, as you know, they did. There is this huge disconnect in what we think we are buying when we pass the largest budget in the legislature and what we are actually getting. I'm a strong believer of local control, and I'm not advocating that we micromanage every school or every expenditure. But at some level, there has to be a way for the legislature to know that the billions of dollars it sends to schools meets a few expectations, or that there are at least some rules or some agreements. So this measure before you simply asks the Department of Education to look at this and look for ways to do this. It directs them to study existing data that the department has or can obtain without any new reports coming from the schools. Schools don't have to do anything. Now, in committee, we heard from some of the people that I would affectionately call the protectors of the status quo about saying we don't need a law to do this, we can just verbally ask them to do this. But that's the executive branch and we're the legislative branch. And I think on some questions, we do need a higher profile to meet those expectations. We do need a directive. And sometimes when we ask people to do things, they don't always do them. So that's the purpose of doing legislation instead of just picking up the phone, can you guys look at this? We also talked about the fact that our schools are underfunded. And I've said for many years that every level of education from preschool to higher education that we are underfunded and that this is somehow a substitute for funding. And I don't want to anyone to believe that this is doing that, but I don't think more useful information will be harmful. In fact, I think if we could come to some understanding about how this large budget that we pass is actually spent, that information would be useful. Because the way this manifests itself, for example, is I'd like to add, say, 10 or 15 days to the school year. All of the research suggests this is one of the best things we can do, and it's very intuitive. More time in school enhances comprehension and learning. Every day for a full day of school costs about $35 million. So say we wanted to do 10 more days and add $350 million to the budget. If we just did that, there would be no guarantee that all schools would add 10 more days because they don't have to. And they might have different priorities, which is fine. But that right there would be sort of an incentive not to go for extra days. So, again, no one is saying that districts are misspending or that their priorities are out of line, but the K through 12 budget is the biggest budget we ever pass. There should be some way for all of us to be on the same page with education policy, and somehow we need to make sense of a system of equalization that results in a system that is so unequal.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for the senator? All right, thank you very much. Representative Doherty.
Short. I feel shorter. Okay, Representative Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Margaret Doherty, and I am the state representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland, and I am also chair of the House Education Committee. So I'm here today to express my opposition to Senate Bill 1541 for several reasons. Now, I want to be clear that I believe that the intentions of this bill and its sponsors are honorable. However, I strongly believe that this bill takes us down the wrong road and asks the wrong questions. I spent my entire adult career working in education, first as a teacher, then as a labor representative. I've worked with small school districts, big school districts, rich schools, poor schools, and schools with a very wide range of demographics. I've worked in the urban areas, I've worked in the rural areas, I've worked in the coastal areas, I've worked in Central Oregon. All schools are different, just like all of our local communities are different. More importantly, the students in each community have very different needs. In Oregon, we have a strong tradition of entrusting local school boards and budget committees and superintendents to understand the needs of their students and their communities and to spend the education dollars wisely. These local officials live and work in the community. They talk to parents and teachers every day, and they really understand the needs of the students. I also want to add that I not only worked in large schools, big schools, I also worked in times where we had money, times we had no money. I worked at school districts before Measure 5 and after Measure 5. So I've literally seen almost every scenario in a school district when it comes to funding. In a state the size of Oregon and as diverse as Oregon, trusting local communities is a necessity. One size fits all solutions do not work. This legislation second guesses our history of locally bargained decisions making, and passing it would send the wrong message to parents, teachers, and schools. This bill requires a statewide evaluation of district expenditures, but it does more than that. It requires the department to determine whether district expenditures are casually or causally related to student outcomes. Nothing in this bill accounts for the differences in local communities. In my opinion, these omissions render the findings of this legislation irrelevant. Additionally, this bill only looks at the small piece of the equation. Not only does it ignore the inadequacy of Oregon's investment to our schools, it also ignores the vast disparity of local revenue. It's easy to point fingers at schools in low-income communities and blame their expenditure decisions for insufficient student outcomes. But these schools oftentimes do not have local option levies. They don't have bonds that can upgrade their facilities, and they don't even have booster clubs to help the schools or PTAs. Out of necessity, these schools have to spend their limited statewide dollars differently. Given this, do we really think comparing the expenditures of Ontario to Portland, or Lake Oswego to Umatilla, or Astoria to Bend will be a useful exercise? Comparing the expenditures themselves, void of any content, will not provide any helpful information. In fact, it could paint an incomplete and misleading picture of why student outcomes are occurring. The implication of this bill is clear. People in Salem can figure out how to spend education dollars better than local communities can. I strongly disagree with that notion, and I urge the committee to oppose the bill. Thank you very much. And we also have Representative Springer here also to speak on it.
Excellent. Thank you.
So I'm open for questions.
All right, Representative Springer, do you want to?
come up?
Careful, those white chairs are super dangerous.
Somebody have a phone book I can sit on?
They're very squirrely.
You planned that.
Do we have booster chairs?
Wow. Okay, feeling 6 years old right now. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. Thank you for this opportunity to address you today. I come to you from a couple different positions. Number one, obviously, as a legislator, but maybe just as importantly, if not more importantly, an elected local school board member for 5 years, and I chaired that board for two of those years. I have some concerns about the bill. I think the bill's trying to get to a great place, but I don't know that this is the path to get to that great place. And as I think about a couple things, this bill, based on the language, is looking for data, is looking for accountability, and those are really good things. When it comes to data, we have access to some of the data this bill is looking for right now by means of audits. And we know the ODE collects an enormous amount of data. So we have some data. The second piece, as far as accountability, and I'm always for more accountability, and I think we would lose something if we continue to erode the local control of local school board members. Even 10 years ago when I sat on a school board and was new to this whole arena, there'd be a state policy passed, and I remember sitting around and it dawned on me one day, it wasn't about how to impact our kids, it was how we were going to do what the state told us to do. That was the decision-making process and the policy-making. And so I think that this bill takes more of that latitude away than exists. The other piece is we've talked a lot about compacts in the last few years in our state. This compacts address a piece of this also. We recently passed a bill out of House Ed talking about ELL, how that money is spent. That bill was passed a session ago. We updated it and put the onus of that reporting data onto a Department of Education, which was a good thing. That wasn't an easy bill to pass. It'd been around a while, talking about how to gather this data, and that was one data point. So I think to group it all in one bill is pretty ominous, pretty scary, quite frankly, for local school districts. Do we need accountability? Yes. Do we need audits to make sure money is where it's supposed to be going? Absolutely. I think that's probably why in the last couple sessions there have been initiatives funded and the money had to go to those initiatives. So I think the direction is just fine. It's a direction that this body has been on a path of for the last few years. I don't know that this gets us there.
Questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much. Oh,
question.
Yes, Representative Rayfield.
Did you talk to your Tigard Tualatin School Board to see what they thought about this, Representative Doherty?
Mr. Rayfield, who, by the way, is a graduate of Tigard High School. Yes, I did. I'm always in communication with the Tigard Tualatin School Board.
Oh, I don't know who they are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure you're aware of the wide disparity in funding in Oregon schools. I discovered that when I visited in my district at the time, the Paisley School District in Lake County, when I was assigned to represent District 55 after the reapportionment in 2001. that school district had 100 students at that time, and had a budget per student of approximately double the budget for the June 4th Day School District where I had been on the school board just a couple of years before. So it isn't a fact, is it, that the districts are funded identically. The reality is, of course, that we fund school districts based on the formula, and the formula leads to very different results depending upon local conditions and circumstances. That hasn't changed since 2002 in any appreciable way, has it?
Well, what it is, I think part of it is we've got X amount of dollars from school funding, but yes. We also have a lot of districts that have local options. We have a lot of districts where foundations raise a lot of money for programs that go directly to teachers, where you've got other districts that don't. And so if you go through and try to compare budgets with student achievement, you have other districts that local option money, you know, is in the formula but not necessarily in the school formula, and that makes a big difference to the achievement of, I mean, if you've got a foundation that can go through and hire two extra teachers per building, like we do in Tigard, that's something that's very important. But I think if you look at school funding, I go way back. I go back to school funding in 1975. And if you go through, we had local options, we had local tax bases. We had districts that did not have tax bases. We had districts that had tax bases that had been passed in 1913. The district that I was in North Clackamas did not have a tax base. Every year we had to go through and try to get a local option levy to operate the schools. And for 4 years I was laid off every day, every year for the first day of school. And the reason was is we had not passed a local option. So districts have been funded in very strange ways, and now apparently there's a uniform way, but we still have some districts that are able to raise more funds than other districts. And to go through and have their assessment based on funding, sometimes, again, the facts are a little bit different and how they get some of the funding. And every school district is different.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, and just a little bit of a follow-up on that, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We have small school adjustments. We have all sorts of adjustments. We have a weighted system. And as I look at this bill, I'm thinking of one school district up towards the Portland area somewhere, smaller school district in a metro area, though, gets a small school adjustment and yet has a lot of other dollars that flow into that school district. And call it sour grapes or whatever you want to call it, I'll take one of my districts of equal size. We get an adjustment because we're a small school and we don't have the other stuff. I'll bet you if we wanted to make this an apples to apples comparison and we looked at test scores and we looked at graduation rates and we looked at not the dollars coming in, but we looked at these same elements based on similar school sizes, I bet the school district I'm thinking of has a lot better data than the school district maybe that's down in my district. And that doesn't mean folks in my district aren't doing a good job. So until we can rectify some of those issues, I think it's really hard to lay this template down and compare those.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I am gonna close the public hearing for right now on Senate Bill 1541A, and I'm gonna open a public hearing on House Bill 4004.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4004 directs legislative administrator to use national statuary hall replacement funds to maintain and commission statues of Chief Joseph and Mark Hatfield to be placed in the statuary hall in the United States Capitol. It directs the administrator to request the architect of Capitol to seek approval of the Joint Committee on Library of Congress for replacement statues of John McLaughlin and Jason Lee. It directs the administrator to place McLaughlin and Lee statues in appropriate places of honor in the state of Oregon. It establishes the National Statuary Hall Replacement Fund, requires gifts, grants, donations received to fund the National Hall Statuary Replacement Project Fund, and declares emergency effective upon passage. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you do have an explanatory statement from Legislative Fiscal about the potential cost when monies are raised, what the estimated cost will be to complete this project. It also stipulates that no general fund monies can be used or placed or deposited in this fund. It is intended to come from gifts and other donations.
Great, thank you. So I think we'll start the testimony with Oregon's third senator, Mr. Frank. Come on down and invite up Representative Boone and Representative Barker to join him. And careful of those chairs, they're squirrely.
Madam Chair, honorable representatives. I'm Jerry Frank. I'm a native Oregonian. I have 8 generations of my family in Oregon. And I'm very proud to be a great booster of this state. My uncle was governor of the state, and our family has had a deep history in involvement in good works for this great state. For 26 years, I had the honor of serving as chief of staff for Mark Hatfield in Washington and chaired 14 of his campaigns for governor and senator, and we never lost one. Mark Hatfield was an incredible gentleman. If you take a look at the record of this man and all of the good things for our state, if it's in education, if it's in parks, if it's in power, if it's in ocean activities, you'll see that he had an incredible background and knowledge of what had been done and what should be done for our state. But there was one thing, ladies and gentlemen, that differentiated Mark Hatfield from many others. He was a calm, collected gentleman, never, ever being harsh with his words or his activities. He was beloved in the United States Senate by members on both sides of the aisle. As a matter of fact, his closest friend in the United States Senate was Senator Bobby Byrd, who certainly didn't share many of the things that Mark Hatfield was in favor of. I speak today to implore you fine ladies and gentlemen to consider putting a statue of Mark Hatfield in the Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol. My friends, in these days where we are seeing both on the national and the state scene harsh words, name-calling, and anything but good vibes between various factions, if Mark Hatfield was alive today, he would be the person leading the charge to ensure that there was calm and deliberate words being spoken on both sides. My friends, he was an incredible Oregonian, and in my opinion, he deserves to be recognized in the Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Frank? Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And before I say my speech, which is very long, I just want you to know, Representative Kenny Geyer asked me to let you know that she would have stayed, but she had an appointment at 3:30 at a homeless service outside the building, and so she supports the bill and she supports the sponsor. So I just wanted to say, in 2013, I was in the Statuary Hall and saw all the statues there, and that even that little spot where you can whisper and hear somebody clear across the room. And it just begged for a statue of Mark Hatfield, I have to say that. So as you can tell, I support this bill. And I really liked Mark Hatfield a lot. My parents voted for him. He was one of the first people when I first voted, I could vote for, even though he was a Republican, it's okay. and I was a Democrat. But he was exactly what Mr. Frank said, just a gentleman, and really, really suited to that role and deserves this honor. I also know he was against nuclear energy and nuclear war. Excuse me, nuclear war, not the energy. But as was I in my early days of advocating for such things, in a more polite way than some of our recent experiences with protests. But I was always an anti-nuke. But I think one of the things that Representative Gilliam told me is that he came back to the district at least once every month. And that's a big deal because it's a long flight and they're busy anyway, but that's a big deal for 30 years to come back every month someplace in Oregon. But I'll just bet you that he found the time or somehow to get a piece of cake from the Konditorei because it's the absolute best. So I just want you to know I support it. I hope you do too, and I hope that we see this happen. And Representative Gilliam, you've done a great job on this, and so you are to be congratulated. And as I bestowed a sainthood today on John Mullen in committee, I would like to do the same to you. Saint Vic.
Oh, my.
Oh, can't beat that. Representative Barker.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, committee, for the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28. I'm a strong supporter of this measure. Also including Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce tribe, some of the Native American people who have been here for thousands of years and the great things he did. As a child, one of my first books was a book, an autographed book about Chief Joseph. And my dad explained how he fooled the army by dragging sagebrush behind, making a big cloud, and the army went chasing the wrong, two people on a horse instead of a real army. And as an old Marine, I'm not surprised the Army was that easily fooled. But, Senator Hatfield was, always kind of a model when he was governor. My mother-in-law actually baked a birthday cake for him that one time that had the theme of him ending up in the White House many years ago in Portland. And one of the things that Representative Boone touched on, at a time when the Vietnam War was in its early stages, it was very unpopular to oppose that. Very unpatriotic, very un-American, but Senator Hatfield stood up and opposed that war. And he knew it was wrong. And he, as a young naval officer, landed in Nagasaki and saw that right after the war and saw what had happened there. I was in Japan some 15 years later when I was in the Marines and went to both Nagasaki and Hiroshima and saw the museums. And the horror that was in the museums, I can only imagine what it was like seeing it firsthand. Those are pretty horrific events. And I just was always proud that my senator from Oregon was one of the people who was objecting to the Vietnam War at the time. And, eventually it became popular to be opposed to, but it surely wasn't when he stood up virtually alone in those early days. And so I would strongly recommend, too, that we have these statues put into the cycle there and put back into D.C. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but I just wanted to say a comment. I wanted to thank you all for being here, particularly Mr. Frank for coming. And I just wanted to share briefly, we talk about how much Senator Hatfield came back and was still very connected to the state and his communities. And I just wanted to share, as an elected, we've all had staff that work for us. And I used to work for Senator Wyden. And I had a colleague who worked for Senator Hatfield for many years. And she spoke about how wonderfully he treated his staff as well. And this is somebody who had been, in the highest quarters of power, influential for many years across many areas. And still, every time he was back in the state, he came to the office. He knew the name and of everyone who worked for him. And he would walk around the office and check in with everybody. He would remember if your mom hadn't been well or if you had had trouble with some of your kids, I'm projecting. and he would, and every time he was in the state, he would do that. And he stayed connected. He, with all the folks who worked for him, he earned, I know Representative Gilliam and I have talked about this, but he truly, it was just a demonstration of really what a fine and good person he was as well on a personal level. So I just wanted to share that aspect of him, and thank you again for being here for this.
Representative Hoyle.
I also don't have a question for the panel, but I want to thank you so much for sharing why you think that we should have that statue, especially now, as a power of example in Statuary Hall. And I was trying to think of the right words to say, and I went back and found the press release that Senator Peter Courtney sent when Mark Hatfield died. And I just want to read those words, because I think what he stated is the exact reason why we should have that statue. The statement by Senate President Peter Courtney said, "Senator Hatfield's legacy represents governing the way it ought to be, with a focus on solutions rather than sound bites. Even as he was making history as a legislator or governor or U.S. senator, he recognized the importance of Oregon's heritage. He knew that without our history, we would have no soul, no spirit. Today, Senator Hatfield is our history. He was and always will be the soul and spirit of Oregon and her people, and I can think of no better statue to have in Statuary Hall. So I'm hopeful that we will pass this through, and I am hopeful that the Senate and the Senate President will see fit to allow this bill to move for these reasons."
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. And I just want to say, Mr. Frank, when we pass this bill, we will celebrate with cake. Thank you. So next up, we have Representative Reed, Representative Taylor, and I don't know if that's all I've got on the list. So if you're a representative and you want to speak, there's one empty chair. All right. Yeah, Representative Peluso.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, Gresham. So first I want to start off with, I really wasn't intending to speak. That's for my friend Vic, because he really doesn't like it when we say that on the House floor. So I just want to just take a few moments of your time. I want to give the Willamette University Bearcat shout out to Mark Hatfield, who did serve as president of the university for a handful of years. He brought status, he brought clout, he brought expertise that really advanced Willamette in its mission to serve the best and to learn from the best. And again, it was an honor. Before I graduated, I was able to see Mark Hatfield there and shake his hand. And again, it was just an honor and a privilege, and what it has done for the many alum, and continues, his legacy continues through the library that's named after him and a fountain that's named after him. So those of us who are Bearcats hold his legacy very high. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Williamson, members of the House Committee on Rules. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, House District 41. I am here because Representative Gilliam and I were chatting on the floor, and he asked me to come and to share a little bit of a story, and so I have a little bit of a different testimony here today. I support this bill because I think it is important to memorialize an additional legendary Oregonian in Washington, D.C. Therefore, I agree with Representative Gilliam that we should include Chief Joseph as one of the statues we send to our nation's capital. The reason Chief Joseph should be included is because he was an advocate for his people and actively opposed injustice, and he fought tirelessly against forced removal of Native Americans and systematic discrimination. Chief Joseph was born on March 3, 1840, in the Willamette Valley Indian Territory. When the United States attempted to force the Nez Perce to move to a reservation in 1877, he reluctantly agreed. Following the killing of a group of white settlers, tensions erupted again, and Chief Joseph tried to lead his people to Canada in what he was considered one of the great retreats in military history. Chief Joseph became especially well known after this battle, and due to the eloquent surrender speech he gave when he was pursued by the U.S. Army from his homeland in the Wallawa Mountains of northeast Oregon in Bear Paw, Montana. The Nez Perce thought they had made it safely to Canada, but unfortunately they did not. The reason Representative Gilliam asked me to testify in this bill is because of the unusual connection my family has to Chief Joseph at this specific period of time.
The man who wrote down Chief Joseph's famous speech, which ended with, my heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. This was written down by my husband's great-great-grandfather, C.E.S. Wood. C.E.S. Wood was then a 25-year-old West Point graduate serving as an aide de camp to General O.O. Howard in 1877 when Chief Joseph surrendered. C.E.S. Wood, again my husband's great-great-grandfather, became close friends with Chief Joseph, and one of his five children went on then to live with Chief Joseph. And in our home and in our, many of my husband's family's relatives' homes are many things that were gifts from Chief Joseph and from the Nez Perce that continue on. And still to this day, the Nez Perce honors my husband's family with various things because of this deep connection. And so the reason there's this unusual connection between Chief Joseph and my husband's family is an example of the deep history that exists between our Native American, Northwest Native American tribes and early settlers. And I think it's important that this part of Oregon history be on display at the national level in D.C., along, of course, with Senator Hatfield. And so I want to thank Mr. Gilliam for the lovely conversations that we've had on this. It's a little bit awkward talking about my husband's family, but we wanted to share that there's this long history of, obviously, Senator Hatfield was a wonderful, amazing man. However, Chief Joseph, of course, is someone that I think we can all agree was the true Oregonian and should be represented in our nation's capital as well. So for that reason, I'm supporting House Bill 4004.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. These are two tough acts to follow, especially because I'm among the few non-native Oregonians and among the few people who didn't work for Senator Hatfield in some form or another. At the same time, like Representative Peluso, I share something in common with the senator. I'm also a graduate of Willamette. And when I got to Willamette as a sophomore, I transferred. There were a couple of things that were really evident to me, and I want to just mention the two things that have really stuck with me about Senator Hatfield. I knew a little bit when I got there, but his presence in a physical sense, the library, the fountain, and when he came to campus reinforced it, and so I started to learn more. And the two anecdotes or vignettes that really, I think, captured him for me are the story that many know about 1965. Representative Barker already mentioned it at a meeting of the National Governors Association. Our Governor Hatfield was the only governor to oppose a resolution offered by the National Governors Association to support President Johnson and the conduct of the Vietnam War. Fast forward 30-plus years at a time when I was a student at Willamette and the balanced budget amendment was making its way through Congress, Senator Hatfield stuck by his principles and opposed that. But that's impressive enough. But what was even more impressive, I think, was the offer he made to then Majority Leader Dole to resign his position as senator immediately and allow that the amendment to move forward. I also think Majority Leader Dole, he's not an Oregonian, so he's not relevant to this conversation about the bill, but he also provided a model and something I think we should all aspire to in rejecting that offer out of hand and allowing people, allowing Senator Hatfield to stick to his position, but not suggesting that the Senate, the country, the state lose that tremendous power and skill. So I've been part of this conversation in the past with Representative Gilliam. It's my last chance as a member of the House to offer my comments and support, so I didn't want to miss it. And I appreciate you giving me the chance to tell those two quick vignettes. I hope you'll support the bill, and I hope we'll all get to celebrate the installation of these statues at some point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions or comments? Thank you very much. Rick Rolfe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, representatives, for this opportunity. My name is Rick Rolfe. I served as Senator Hatfield's Director of Policy and Communications. I was with him for more than 10 years. The principal work I did with him was for foreign policy and national security. So I come at this, I think, from a little bit different perspective than a lot of people do. Millions of people go to Statuary Hall from all over the world every year. And I think sometimes in Oregon we tend, although his accomplishments here are pretty amazing, we tend to think about it in somewhat more provincial terms than some people who would see him. And I'm here to try to make the case that Senator Hatfield, we've all heard about him going to Hiroshima, many of you have. He landed landing craft at Iwo Jima, where the blood was literally frothing on that beach. And it affected him so much that he didn't see a war movie for the rest of his life, not one. And the amazing thing is, when you send his statue, when you nominate him to go to Statuary Hall, he will literally be the first senator to have served in combat from the greatest generation in World War II to have a statue in Statuary Hall. And not only that, because of his experiences doing that, he became, I would also argue, not just one of the best, but the greatest champion of anti-war and pro-peace of the entire 20th century. I would invite anybody to come up with the other nomination for that. I've tried to punch holes in my own argument, and I can't find it. There was nobody who was more indefatigable than him in these areas. But I do want to point out, I think sometimes when we get a little ideological, sometimes he gets the rap of being soft on defense and so forth. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. He was the strongest champion of the all-volunteer army, for supporting the National Guard out here, for he submitted a bill to have an assistant secretary of readiness at the Defense Department because he felt that equipment and things like that were being neglected because we were stealing, in his view, from the soldiers to pay for nuclear weapons when all we were doing was making the rebel bounce over and over and over again, when we could also destroy the world with it. We already had a million Hiroshimas. And so to him, that was wrong. The other conservative perspective I sometimes hear about him is about the balanced budget amendment. And people can legitimately, they don't have to agree with him, and I'm not going to persuade you to change your view if you've got a problem with that. But I do want you to know that he got into a very interesting conversation with President Reagan at the White House one day. President Reagan had the whole leadership of the Congress down there, and he was particularly beating up on the Appropriations Committee, which Senator Hatfield chaired, about deficits. And Senator Hatfield stood up and he said, "Mr. President, I want you to know that the budget of my committee is coming in every year less than what you have requested. We spent less money with him as the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and he was very proud of this. Now, did he move some things around because he exercised his power, the power of the purse? Yes, he did. He diverted $100 billion out of defense spending, which was rocketed through the up into the sky anyway, and which is why, for human needs, which is why the world's largest research hospital at NIH dedicated to vexing diseases is named after him. So just to close, he was just such a wonderful person, too, as Jerry said. You know, it's very unusual for somebody to be a good man and a great man, both, and he was. And I think there's nothing better you can do than to have his statue out there in Statuary Hall as those congressmen and those senators go through those swinging doors, to have him standing there looking at him. And boy, his blue eyes, when he wanted to let you know about the truth, you felt it. It was really, really something. And also, just let me say, I think that the senator and Chief Joseph, by the way, Senator Hatfield was also indisputably, I invite anybody to shred up my argument, was the greatest champion in the Senate, bar none, for Indians. Not really good, the best. And so I think he and Chief Joseph would get along extraordinarily well in there. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much.
One comment.
Yes.
if you will allow me, with Jerry Frank in the room, who hired Rick Rolfe and myself, you came after, because you're so young, Madam Chair. I was guilted by Tobias Reed's comment that he was among the minority that never worked for Senator Hatfield. I want to clarify with Jerry in the room, I was on staff. It's a stretch to say I worked for Senator Hatfield. Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying the record, Representative Gilliam. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4004. I will open a work session on House Bill 4004. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my honor to move House Bill 4004 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 4004 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Not. Motion carries. The carrier of the bill will be Representative Gilliam and Representative Clem. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 4004. I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1541A. And I will invite up Phil, Joel, and Persa. Hi, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and members of the House Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Parisa Chanrami, representing Stand for Children. On behalf of Stand, we encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1541A. We want to thank Senator Haas for all of his hard work on this bill. Earlier, this bill passed the Senate with an overwhelming bipartisan majority vote. We support this bill because it would help lawmakers, district leaders, parents, and community members learn more about the district's spending landscape. And we'll also learn more about which investments are making a difference for student outcomes, like reducing chronic absenteeism, as well as boosting the high school graduation rates. We believe this study is very timely and valuable, especially when one in six kids in Oregon is chronically absent, and only 74% of our high school students graduate on time. Those two numbers put Oregon at the bottom of the pack compared to other states around the nation. This study will be low cost. It'll give us very important and valuable information about how much districts are spending in core categories that include instruction, administration, teaching and learning, all of those pieces. And it'll also work to identify and look at multiple factors that that will influence district spending when it comes to the school calendar, when it comes to class size, as well as when it comes to compensation and administrative costs. We think that knowing what and how these factors may shape district spending will be helpful, because the more information we have, the more well-informed decisions we can make around district spending. Most importantly, and this will be my last note, this study will also look at whether differences in district spending are related to student outcomes, like reducing chronic absenteeism or boosting the graduation rates. This will be imperative. This is a unique study. It's low cost, it's one time, and it'll give us essential information to know which investments are having an impact on student learning and success. With that, thank you again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Phil.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Chalkboard Project here in support of Senate Bill 1541. This legislation is right in line with the work we've done with Open Books, which seeks to share budget information with the public in a simple, straightforward manner. and in a manner that's easy to understand. Open Books is already capturing a lot of the information that is called for in this study, which is part of the reason why I suspect it has such a low fiscal, because we've got the data. But what 1541 does is it offers or requests the department to provide some analysis, some evaluation to that information. We think this improves transparency. It's a good bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Joel.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing businesses all across Oregon, both big and small. The chorus that you have been hearing and will hear from opponents is that more data, more problems. A lot of data can help. Having more data is not necessarily a bad thing. Just because this seems to be incomplete, it does get us closer to knowing more and being able to make better decisions. So with that, we urge your support for House Bill 1541. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Next panel, Morgan, Lori, and Chuck.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. We oppose Senate Bill 1541. You've heard some of the other testimony. We believe that we have 197 unique school districts, and it's the role of locally elected school boards, budget committees, and superintendents, community members, to decide how to prioritize investments in their local schools. We don't agree that reviewing just expenditure reports is a complete measurement of why decisions are made at the local level. Our concern is that the bill does not address the real source of our very real struggles to improve student achievement and graduation rates in Oregon. We've been on a 12-year decline. We're just coming out of a recession. We're 3 years into reinvesting into our schools. We have a roadmap to get the achievement we want in the state. It's called the Quality Education Model. We choose not to fund that. It shouldn't surprise anyone that if you have one of the shortest school years in the state, some of the largest class sizes, and over 80% of your local budgets are going to salaries and benefits, that you're not going to be able to make the investments that you need to. Just to give you an example of what, we have, compared to 2008, 2009, we have 5,000 fewer people. That's teachers, administrators, nurses, support staff working in our K-12 system than we did in the 2014-15 school year, 5,000. We had 66,000 people working in our K-12 system 7 years ago. We've got 61,000 working there today. And our members would argue that if you want to make improvements, you have to make sustained investments over the time. And I think, to close our testimony, I think our biggest concern about this bill is there seems to be a continued trend in this building to find silver bullets to try to answer the question, what's going wrong with our schools? Why aren't we doing better? We've gone through, over the last 5 years, we've had OEIB, we've had Tight Loose, we've had achievement compacts, we've had all kinds of different changes. Tons and tons of different people coming through the Department of Ed, the Chief Education Office. And it just feels like this bill is another attempt to find a silver bullet to fix a problem with our schools. And I think we actually agree with the proponents of this bill that expenditures do impact student outcomes. And our argument would be that we're not making enough expenditures in our K-12 system to get the outcomes that we want. So do we have an expenditure problem in our schools? I think the answer is yes. But our members would say that's because we aren't making the investments necessary to get the outcomes we want. Again, we have that roadmap. We have the quality education model. The Department of Education and the staff there already have best practices and the places to make investments. We know where we would spend the money if we had it. We just don't have it to spend. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, not representing the status quo. We have great big dreams for our students, and the status quo won't be sufficient for them to reach them. But we, in all seriousness, represent 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association and respectfully submit our concerns as well regarding Senate Bill 1541, which seems like the classic solution in search of a problem. The bill directs the Department of Education to evaluate school district budget decisions, to evaluate budget decisions by school district boards, and to make a subjective judgment about that budget plan's effectiveness in each of the 197 school districts. It also calls on the department to compare districts to each other and examining variations and trying to come up with a reason or reasons why different districts make different choices for different populations. The uninitiated eye might see this as an innocent and interesting fishing trip, but those of us who've been through the disruptions and failed experiments of the most recent educational reform era in Oregon are understandably wary. Given that the bill contemplates assigning this report and evaluation to the department and not to a work group process that would have a lot of public involvement, there'd be no opportunity to question, challenge, correct, or otherwise impact the lens with which the author of the report would choose to apply to this project. There'd be no opportunity for public input into the methodologies, theories, assumptions, or conclusions of the author. There'd be no partnering, data gathering, or testimony, and no scrutiny of drafts prior to the presentation by ODE before our legislative committee next December, unlike all the other kinds of processes we've seen over the many years that we have studied this question over and over again. To draw inferences from data is not necessarily to convey to you facts. It is to insert opinion, and the opinion of one person without your guidance of what the parameters or sidebars might be. So absent your guidance on such questions, the work product will reflect only one point of view of one employee charged with generation of an analysis. If the department does have all the information they need to do this, then legislative direction is unnecessary and the bill is unnecessary. The department may do this. So there would be no need for any expenditure of any resource or a bill to be passed. It's also true that there are many, many ways to get the same data that is requested in this bill, if data is all you want, not opinion. The Open Books Project, which was previously mentioned, compares districts to districts. If you want to know financial accountability of school districts, there's one online one-stop access to all 197 district municipal audits that come out every year. If you want to explore how different spending might impact outcomes, all you have to read is the latest report of the Quality Education Commission, which does its matched pair research and best practices research every year. And finally, if you want to go at a more granular level to look at the link between revenues and expenditures and outcomes for school districts and ESDs, you can look at the reports of the School Revenue Forecast Committee, which also meets every biennium. And finally, the research canon on school finance academia is replete with studies of the most effective and efficacious ways to use public funds to elicit optimal educational results in our public schools. Once again, we've not heard a pressing need for this bill. It's not been demonstrated. The data exists. All you have to do is find it online. It's there. And we note that the factors that affect budgets include community priorities and local concerns, which may not be an apples-to-apples comparison. You might have one district that prefers to put more of its resources in one sort of program and less in others. They may have a shortened year so that they can have smaller class sizes, because you can't always have both with the resources at the table. That's a community-based decision and ought not be second-guessed, and we would certainly not want to see an unelected official making a substitute of his judgment for that of local school boards in his analysis to you. It would seem that this bill is predicated on the notion, as my colleague has mentioned, that public school outcomes are all about how money is spent and not on how much money is sent. For all these reasons, we urge you not to pass Senate Bill 1541. Thank you.
Thank you. Chuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, about 2,200 superintendents, high school, elementary school principals, as well as central office administrators. Our organization opposes this bill. We opposed it in the Senate. We're back to oppose it here. If our organization believed this study would do anything, I mean anything, about graduation rates, chronic absentee rates, or any of the other issues mentioned to you, we would be here to support it. It doesn't. It merely looks at existing data, And as my colleagues have described, puts it through an individual's analysis of it. And I'd be glad, I think all of us would be glad to come in and give you similar analyses of the data as the representative from Chalkboard Project mentioned. Open Books, if any of you have had a chance to look at the Open Books portion of the Chalkboard Project website, it provides this data analyzed and put together for you to take a look at it. I also want to kind of correct, I think, the record. The representative from the Oregon Business Association suggested this would produce more data. This does not produce one iota of new data on our education system. We are data mined. You're looking at an area that is just a tunnel. There's no vein left to dig for. It's all housed at probably on about the fifth floor of some building in cardboard boxes if somebody will go in and data mine it, or it's on a computer if someone wants to go in. But the data's been collected. It's all there. We've looked at it. The Quality Education Commission has looked at it. We agree with our colleagues that there are solutions. The solutions involve investment. We will continue to talk to you about investment. We will continue to, as an organization, along with our colleagues, along with the folks bringing the bill, to look for best practices constantly. We just completed at our organization a 2-day seminar on teaching children of poverty, just best practices on teaching children of poverty. We deal with these issues constantly, looking for best practices. This will not get us there. This gets us nowhere. This just is either a job creator or I'm not sure what. I'll just leave it alone. I won't go any further than that in terms of what this appears to be. But we're really definitely opposed to this. This brings nothing to the table.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for this panel? Thank you very much. Tim Cowan. If there's anybody else who wants to testify, that's last of my list. Careful.
Chair, committee members, I'm going to be brief because of the time you spent on this. The church I belong to, South Lake Church,
identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, Tim Cowan.
Thank you.
Entered into an agreement with Roosevelt High School, St. John's Community, and the Portland School District. We've been there about 6 years. Nike came in and put in a second best sports facility in Portland, and a member like Neil Lomax coaches the football team. The reason why I think it's important for me to bring this up, it had the greatest improvement in graduation rates in the state. And we didn't use $1 of public money. We built a model on how to do that. And it's been expanded to about 18 communities around the country. One of the last ones was Detroit. And a large group is starting to take this project on. And the only reason I bring it up is because this issue about cost of education, Department of Education, what I would like you to do is to have the Department of Education look at what we've been able to accomplish in increasing the graduation rates, not costing a dime, that we have the template for it that can go out across the state in any way you want to. So please take a look at that and have them report on that either before or after. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1541A. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1528A and invite up Karen Quigley.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, 1528A requires members of the Commission on Indian Services who are not members of the Legislative Assembly to be appointed from nominees selected through the tribal councils or their governing body, and provides that members of majority of members of the Commission who are not members of the Legislative Assembly for purposes of business does not constitute a quorum when attending certain gatherings and functions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Quigley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. I've served in that capacity for a little over 20 years, which is about 50% of the commission's existence that was founded by Governor Vic Atiyah when he was the legislator. And first, I must say, what an honor to be here the afternoon. You are considering the contribution of both Senator Mark Hatfield and Chief Joseph to this incredible heritage we have here in Oregon. This bill actually does a couple of things to clarify what I'm quite sure has always been the purpose of the commission. It adds explicitly that one of the purposes is to promote communication and positive state-tribal relations. Across the nation, Oregon is a model, first of all, because of your legislative action to pass the first in the nation state government-to-government bill, and also because of its effectiveness in terms of avoiding litigation, which many, many other states and tribes throughout the United States find themselves involved in. The bill, in addition, just makes clear that for a thing that the commission does not do, which is interfere with negotiations or other relationships that individual tribes might have with the state, might have with the federal government, might have with local governments, and it adds tribal governments. The purpose of the commission is not to get in the middle of intertribal matters. Basically, the main purpose of the bill is to acknowledge and respect tribal sovereignty and to make certain that the legislature is clear in its understanding that this is a body of 10 sovereigns. The 14-member advisory body has a tribal leader from each of the 9 federally recognized governments in Oregon, 4 legislators, including Representative Catty McEwen and Representative Dwayne Stark, and a non-voting member appointed by the commission. All the other members are jointly appointed by the Senate president and the speaker. What the bill makes clear, which has always been the case, that each tribal government decides who is going to be their representative. In addition, and most importantly to members of the commission, it acknowledges and clarifies that we all understand that these tribal elected officials are tribal elected government officials 24/7. They are including the times that they are outside of commission meetings. For example, the current chair of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services had hoped to be with you today. She is currently meeting at the in Washington, D.C. at the National Congress of American Indians. I don't know for sure, but it's very possible that there are 6 other tribal leaders who also sit on the commission that are in attendance at that meeting. What this bill makes clear is even if they are talking about tribal and state issues, they are not acting on commission business at the National Congress of American Indians. What the bill importantly does not do, it does not change the roles and responsibilities of the members of the commission who are members of the Legislative Assembly. This acknowledgement speaks to the status of the tribal leaders on the commission. And in addition, I would just like to state for the record the meetings of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services for 40 years have always been open public meetings and will continue to be so. There is an emergency clause in this bill, and I think one of the hallmarks of the positive state-tribal relations we have here in Oregon is when we recognize that something is a little off track or there's some misunderstanding between the state and tribal governments, that we don't wait. We do what we can to correct it as soon as possible. So if there is no reason to not acknowledge what tribal leaders have always felt, that they are members, highly committed members of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, but they are sovereign tribal leaders, and there may be federal meetings, state meeting, other tribal meetings or tribal ceremonies, funerals, where a number of them that also serve on the commission are together. So thank you so much for your consideration of this type of acknowledgement.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
I am very supportive of the bill. I just had another question, and that's an administrative one. I see that it has an emergency clause on it, and that means that it goes into effect immediately upon signature of the governor. And there are a lot of bills that don't need that, and I have sort of an issue with that, and I just wondered, does this need an emergency clause and go into effect on passage, or can it go in through the normal process?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for asking that. And if I could just state as strongly as possible that I think in terms of showing respect to the tribal leaders who serve on the commission, there is no reason to wait right this very moment that they may be together at the National Congress of American Indians. Something that by numbers alone could constitute a quorum, but I'm not sure that's the intent. So it's just, I totally understand and appreciate your position about many, many bills that don't need it. If this is some misunderstanding or something that can be taken as not respecting tribal sovereignty, It seems that it would be important for the legislature to consider not waiting. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle.
Thank you very much. I'm also very much in support of this bill. And thank you for Representative Kennemer's question. I do feel like this bill having an emergency clause is important for the reasons that you stated. We do have potential quorum issues when tribal members get together. And so it's not like this is a bill that would be referred to the ballot, so we're not preventing that. But what we are is preventing potential problems. And again, when it's about recognizing tribal sovereignty and really just acknowledging what is the practice already, I think having it go into effect as soon as possible is important, but a fair question to ask.
Yes. Ms. Quigley, thank you for your answer, and also Representative Hoyle. I think it's appropriate. I just wanted to make sure.
No, that's fair.
Right. That's great. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1528 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1528.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I move Senate Bill 1528 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 1528 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carriers will be Representative Stark and Representative McEwen. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1528. I will open a public hearing and work session on 1522.
Somebody ask outside.
Hi, Barbara Smith Warner.
Good afternoon, colleagues. Thank you all for having me. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and not only do I sit on the Rules Committee with you, I also have the honor of representing Northeast Portland Maywood Park and Park Rose, which comprises House District 45 in the Oregon State House of Representatives. I will speak very briefly about this bill today. It is kind of a happy coincidence that some folks who came to talk to me about this bill didn't realize that this bill, 1522, will designate May as Cystic Fibrosis Awareness Month. And I have a number of significant connections to cystic fibrosis in my life and with family and friends. My godparents had cystic fibrosis ran in their family. They lost one of their children to cystic fibrosis as an infant, and they had a number of their grandchildren also ended up with cystic fibrosis, although they have lived significantly longer. Also, one of my best friends from childhood is married to a gentleman with cystic fibrosis who is one of the oldest known survivors of CF. And so just in my life, that is the demonstration of the significant advances that have happened in cystic fibrosis research, from my godparents, children dying in infancy to youth, to my friend's husband, who is now well into his 50s. He has had a double lung transplant, which has had a huge impact on his quality of life. But cystic fibrosis, it is one of those diseases. It impacts the mucus around your lungs and your pancreas in a way that it overproduces it, so that you have to have ongoing regular treatment for it. It can have a significant impact on your quality of life, and as I mentioned, your lifespan. And I just there's a couple things on OLIS, a couple testimonies from parents of folks of kids with cystic fibrosis, and the one short bit I just want to pull out to read, because I think it's an interesting way to think about it, is: if your grandmother was born with cystic fibrosis, she would have likely passed away as an infant. If your mother was born with CF, she might have made it to age 5. If your sister was born with it, she would have started high school, but probably not college. If your daughter was born with it, she would be lucky to live to her late 30s. So this is a disease that, with increased focus and attention and research, it's really responding tremendously. And, you know, not only is sunshine the best disinfectant, but public information is a great way to raise awareness. And the other thing I wanted to quote briefly was, AIDA, awareness leads to interest, which leads to desire, and finally action. So I ask that you join in promoting all of those things by passing this bill to designate May of this year as Cystic Fibrosis Awareness Month.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? I know there were several families that were interested in coming down, courtesy of the short session. This was posted with 28 hours notice. And if you read the testimony that was submitted, these are families that have complicated lives, frankly, because they're dealing with this disease with their children. And so I know that they wanted to be here. They couldn't, but their testimony is an OLIS. Representative Smith Warner actually picked out the exact part I was going to read if you didn't, because I think it's such a great narrative about where we are with this disease and how far we've come, but how far we have yet to go. So thank you very much. With that, I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, with great support, I move Senate Bill 1522 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved with his support Senate Bill 1522 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Not. Motion passes. Carrier is Barbara Smith Warner. With that, I will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1522, and I will open a public hearing and work session on SCR 205. Erin, do you want to tell us what's in there?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 205 honors Alexander Skrlatos for his heroism and service. This measure comes to you with unanimous support of the Senate.
And colleagues, I would, we don't have anyone signed up to testify today. So if you haven't read the concurrent resolution, I asked you to read it. It's this young man is a remarkable young man. He was the one of the young men who subdued a gunman on the Paris in a Paris train, and he I think last
on the 17th.
On the 17th, received the. I want to make sure I get the award. Sorry, Erin. From the governor, he received the Oregon Medal of Honor.
Distinguished Service
Medal, and so it was a really moving ceremony, and we were really proud to be able to have him here at that time and to bestow that award on him. Representative Barnhart.
Well, I would note, I'm doing this from memory now, and it's probably in the resolution, that he also was, along with the others, was given the highest civilian award that the Republic of France can give by the President of France within a few days of that event.
Yes, he received the Knight of the Legion of Honor from the President of France, and a long list of other awards listed in the resolution. So it is definitely worth a read. So with that, I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, with pride for this Oregonian, I move SCR 205 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR 205 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Not. Motion passes. We will determine the carrier at a later date. With that, I will close the public hearing and work session on SCR 205. I will open a public hearing and work session on SCR 201.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 201 honors former Senate President Brady Adams, who passed away in 2015. I will note for the committee that his family was here last week on the 18th, including his son, his wife, and grandson, and they were honored on the Senate floor at that time. So they will not likely be coming back up from San Diego, but they do very much appreciate the honor that has been bestowed upon them and in recognition of his service in the Senate and to Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to see this before me. Brady Adams was a personal friend of mine, an accidental politician, not one of those that ever aspired to be one of us. And he moved to Grants Pass to be a loan officer in the early 70s and wound up being the president of the bank. And I served on the board of directors with him, and just a wonderful guy. When he left politics, he went back to Grants Pass and Evergreen Bank. Evergreen's a mutual. We have no stockholders, so he had a fair amount of money to do great things publicly. And Grants Pass really, during some very down times, always fielded an outstanding display of public art, whether it was Bear Fest, artists turning out wonderful fiberglass bears on all the street corners. He was a zany guy. He came up with the idea of a display called Christmas on Mars. And a large warehouse building that's owned by Evergreen has just become a destination for people to visit during the Christmas season. He also got another interesting idea, interesting bee in his bonnet, to produce something called Bear Fest and the Wild Bunch version of Bear Fest, where he commissioned a number of artists to develop some really cool-looking motorcycles, and he got bears on those motorcycles. And so that was a great display, a traveling display, too. And one of the things that he did for the board of directors of the bank was to get special Harley-Davidson motorcycle jackets. In fact, as I ride away from the Capitol this afternoon, I'll be wearing mine. However, I did strip off the back of the jacket the section that said Wild Bunch, because I don't really want to be a member of the Wild Bunch when I'm riding across Nevada on Highway 50 and run into the real Wild Bunch.
Oh, no.
So anyway, almost everything turned out right. And Brady was just a wonderful guy with a great heart for Oregon and a great heart for Grants Pass, Oregon, USA. So it's a pleasure to speak enthusiastically for this.
Excellent. Thank you. Yes, Representative Kenmer.
Chair, just a couple of comments. I think those were good comments by Representative Wilson, and I had the privilege of serving with him for a number of years in the Senate. And he was a very special fellow. He brought people together, and in those days we had a lot of controversial times between credit unions and banks.
Yeah.
And he was a healing force, actually. And I don't know, he was just a very special person that time spent with Brady was time well spent. And he was very dedicated, and of course ultimately moved up in leadership and made some very substantial contributions to our state.
Thank you. Thank you both. I will take a motion.
With pleasure, Madam Chair. I move SCR 201 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam moves SCR 201 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Motion carries. Do you want to carry?
I'd be happy to.
Representative Wilson will carry. With that, I will close the public hearing and work session on SCR 201, and I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, before us today is LC 325. It is the resolution that we introduce in the legislature, each legislative assembly, that sets the timelines for pre-session filing bills for the next legislative session. And so before you today is the timeline resolution for the 79th Legislative Assembly.
Well, Madam Chair, with excitement, I move LC 325 be introduced as a committee measure.
Vice Chair Gilliam is excited to move LC 325 be introduced as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? If not, LC is introduced. With that, I will close the work session. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
Nothing today, Madam Chair, but as I had visited with most of your staff yesterday, just please be prepared for meetings at any time with an hour's notice for the foreseeable future.
Be flexible. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might want to talk to Representative Hurd on carrying the Scarlatos.
Yeah, that's what I, that was the plan, but thank you very much. All right, with that, we are adjourned.
Yay.
Hey.
Yay.
Hey.
All right, with that, we are adjourned.